The following Dharma talk was recorded in September 2013 in Excelsior Springs, Missouri. It is one of three recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your email sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat teacher, Shyla Catherine, is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focus and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org.
Per special request, tonight I will be speaking about awakening. What is awakening? Enlightenment? Freedom? Liberation? The realization of Nibbana? Are all these terms synonymous? I think the term awakening has a rather day-to-day ring to it, implying a rather ordinary action, something that we do every morning when we wake up. We wake up out of a dream. We wake up to things how they are. We wake up every morning. The Buddha may have intentionally used the image of waking up to counter the rather prevailing assumptions about a mystical, far-off goal. He used a very ordinary term. Although I could try to make some distinctions between these terms, awakening, enlightenment, liberation, freedom, Nibbana, I actually prefer to use them more or less interchangeably to simply refer to the realization of the final goal of this path. Where does the practice lead? It's worth considering. Now, you might say the end of suffering, right? I mean, that's a good Buddhist answer. But then I'd have to ask another question. What is suffering? And what is its end? And then these questions are going to land us squarely in the domain of the Buddha's first teaching, which was on the Four Noble Truths. In his first sermon, he articulated four truths. He said, "Bhikkhus, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What to? The pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial. And the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana." And then he continued, "So long as my knowledge and vision of these Four Noble Truths, as they really are, was not thoroughly purified, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world. But when my knowledge and vision of these Four Noble Truths, as they really are, was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claimed to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. The knowledge and vision arose in me, Unshakable is my liberation of mind. So he is not describing awakening as a transcendent experience or a flash of ecstatic rapture and joy. He's not describing it as a cathartic and explosive sensual experience. Interestingly, it is described as a thorough and penetrative understanding of the four truths of suffering. It is an experience of knowledge, a knowledge that liberates. So the important question that we might ask is not if someone is enlightened or who is enlightened, but enlightened about what? What do we wake up to? What is awakening about? We wake up to suffering, to the cause of suffering, its end and the way to its end. We awaken to the very way that we encounter the world. Does your way of relating to life's experience perpetuate suffering or bring release? What is an awakened relationship to life, to sensory encounters, to suffering? When we look at the mind, the body, and the world, we see experience constantly in flux, experience that is impermanent, unsatisfactory, without a core self. Even pleasant experiences, we discover, are also unsatisfactory. Why? Because they're impermanent. They can't last. When we look squarely at the world, we recognize that we're not going to fix it. There is no fix for it. We're never going to end aging, no matter how many creams you buy. We're not going to end illness, no matter how well you eat. We're not going to end death, loss, or even cruelty and ignorance in the world. When we awakened to the subtle fact that impermanent experience is not a basis for our happiness, then there might be a radical but subtle shift, a shift from attraction to disenchantment, from attachment to non-attachment. The Buddhist teachings use several difficult D words. Terms such as dispassion, disenchantment, detachment. For many people, these can trigger images of an aversive withdrawal from life. But in the context of Buddhist practice, they do not suggest a disconnection with life. Instead, they imply a liberating transformation. Nibbida, the Pali term that's translated as disenchantment, describes the absence of the seductive force of desire. It's not an aversive rejection, but a simple suspension of the fascination that habitually accompanies sensory experience and leads to the seeking of gratification through the senses. A mind that is disenchanted sheds the entanglements that shackle it to this psychophysical process. We simply stop reaching for satisfaction in the realm of more sights, more sounds, more smells, more tastes, and more touches or better thoughts. We know that that is not the realm for our happiness. Ajahn Chah, a master in the Thai forest tradition, likened disenchantment in the mind to the unscrewing of a bolt. The mind is unwound, untangled from the entrenched distortions of attention. Disenchanted, the mind does not seek satisfaction in worldly things. Not because it hates worldly things, quite the contrary, simply because it knows that it is a realm that is unsatisfying. Now, the difficult D word of detachment describes an ease in the mind. Detachment is a very beautiful term. It describes the mind that is not attached, not adhering, not fixated, not identified with that fleeting stream of lived events. There is a definite quality of release. When the mind is caught, it gets unbound. When you think of that bolt that Ajahn Chah referred to, detachment refers to it being unbolted, unhooked, free from the entangling reactions. When the mind is free, it might rest with a calm equanimity towards all experiences, all formations. One continues to perceive experience, to perceive the contact at the senses. But everything that is perceived is understood as it actually is, as impermanent, as unsatisfying, as empty, not self. Dispassion implies an absence of passion, an absence of suffering. In Pali, viraga literally means not lusting after. And this is the term that is usually translated as dispassion, not lusting after. Things happen due to causes and conditions. But those causes and conditions are not our fault. They're often not even our business. And many times they're not under our control. With a flash of insight, a moment when we see things clearly, clinging might cease, and we might experience something beyond the describable and analyzable factors of mind and matter. It's as though the mind recoils from or peels away from that incessant barrage of conditioned mental and material contacts, and it's naturally drawn to the most peaceful and sublime of perceptions, what's called the deathless element, the deathless liberation, or Nibbana. In the Anguttara Nikaya, the meditator's mind at this point is described as it shrinks away from the material and mental. It turns back from it, rolls away from it, and is not drawn toward it. And either equanimity or disenchantment toward it is established in him. Just as a cock's feather or a strip of sinew thrown into a fire shrinks away from it, turns back from it, rolls away from it, and is not drawn toward it. The mind may turn to a vast expression of peace and rest with the ultimate, the inexpressible realization of Nibbana. In the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha said, whatever the phenomena through which beings think of seeking their self-identity, it turns out to be transitory. It becomes false, for what lasts for a moment is deceptive. The state that is not deceptive is Nibbana. That is what men of worth know as being real. With this insight into reality, their hunger ends. cessation, total calm. Essentially, the mind completely lets go of craving for sensual experiences. And then later, the mind will return to ordinary perception. But one finds that a deep shift has occurred, and the chains of craving and attachment have loosened. The mind may be infused with a profound equanimity, and the way of relating to experience has changed. Changed from an interaction based on self-identity and grasping to an infinitely spacious clarity regarding all things. The Buddhist teachings propose an amazing way of living, a way of living that ends greed and hatred and delusion. Just imagine your mind. What would it be like without the corrupting forces of greed and lust and craving and all those movements of wanting and desire? What would it be like without anger and hatred, irritation, remorse, jealousy, fear? What would it be like without conceit and ignorance, restlessness and selfishness? Surely you've all tasted moments, perhaps they were brief, but moments nonetheless, when no defilements were operating, when the mind was quite pure. Remember those moments and imagine what your mind would be like if those corruptions were abandoned, removed forever. Imagine the inner peace that would permeate every interaction and decision, every sensory experience you encountered, every relationship you engaged with. I find it somewhat odd, honestly, that so few people in the world actually want and seek awakening. Most people seek distraction, dullness, and comfort more often than they seek wisdom, clarity, and freedom. Even today, I would venture to say that more people in this country spent the day watching television or gossiping with friends and family than meditating. It's probably a fair bet, isn't it? But even in the Buddhist time, there were very few people who were actually interested in awakening. The Buddha once told his chief disciple, Venerable Sariputta, that whether I teach the Dhamma in brief, or whether I teach it in detail, or whether I teach it both in brief and in detail, those who understand are hard to find. When I speak about awakening or enlightenment or Nibbana, I get a wide range of reactions. Some students get quite irritated, annoyed, even angry, because it might seem irrelevant compared to the urgent personal issues that cause so much stress in life. For some people, hearing about a goal that seems virtually unattainable fuels self-judgment and feelings of worthlessness. For others, it sparks ambition, even arrogance. And for many, it's just confusing, perplexing, bewildering. We may wonder, what is it? Is it possible? Is it really possible now, here, for us? And they wonder, does she know anyone who's enlightened? Or is she really herself? Speaking from experience, is she enlightened? For some people, hearing about enlightenment, though, is inspiring. Like the teaching of the finger pointing to the moon, for a moment we stop focusing on the techniques we're learning, the finger. We stop worrying if we're doing it right, if we've got the right method, the best practice. We stop worrying about the troubles that we're facing and how we might fix them, and the momentary conditions that we're encountering, whether they're pleasant or unpleasant. We stop looking at all these things that surround us, and we look at something awesome that's more intimate, that's more pervasive. We get in touch, perhaps, with an inspired purpose. The Buddha taught a profound path that embraces virtue, that cultivates the mind, and that leads directly to the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion. But who is a reliable authority on the path of awakening and on the subject or experience of awakening? Discussions about awakening often end with very sincere practitioners shrugging their shoulders and asking, "Who knows?" Even in the Buddha's time, there were bhikkhus who overestimated themselves and declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One erroneously. It seems there was a time when quite a large group of monks approached the Buddha and declared their realization, their final knowledge, their awakening. And then some lay people were in the area, and they heard this. And they went to the Buddha and they said, "Is it true? Are all those bhikkhus fully enlightened?" And the Buddha said, "When those bhikkhus declared final knowledge in my presence, there were some who declared final knowledge rightly, and there were some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves." Therein, when bhikkhus declare final knowledge rightly, their declaration is true. But when bhikkhus declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, the Tathagata thinks, "Let me teach them the Dhamma." It's a lovely response. I think there can be some value for not hiding our spiritual successes, because it may be helpful to share our experience of awakening in the world. How will we reduce ignorance if we don't let our light shine? But how can we share our highest realizations without overestimating our attainments, without confusing people who have not had the experience, and without conceit corrupting the perception and stalling further progress? In one discourse, the Buddha warned that if the I arises by claiming enlightenment, it is not enlightenment. He said, "And when this Venerable One regards himself thus, 'I am at peace, I have attained Nibbana, I am without clinging,' that too is declared to be a clinging." So how could a wise person declare their awakening, their freedom? There was one occasion when the Venerable Sariputta indicated to a fellow bhikkhu that he had no doubt and no perplexity in the Dhamma and discipline. And this bhikkhu went to the Buddha and said that Venerable Sariputta had declared final knowledge. And he used a rather stock phrase that said, and we find this phrase repeated many, many times in the discourses, "Destroyed is birth. The holy life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being." And so the Buddha called Sariputta and repeated the report and asked if it was true. Had he indeed declared final knowledge in this way? And Venerable Sariputta said, rather carefully, he said, Venerable Sir, I did not state the matter in those terms and phrases. And so then the Buddha replied very interestingly. He said, in whatever way, Sariputta, a clansman declares final knowledge, what he has declared should be understood as such. I find this to be a very interesting statement, because the Buddha was not quibbling over semantics. He seemed to be encouraging a clearly understood public declaration of one's experience, of one's awakening. And in this dialogue, interestingly, Sariputta seemed hesitant at first to expose his attainment, to speak about his experience. But gradually, when nudged by the Buddha, one question after another, he gained the confidence to declare his own final knowledge. He said, I have no perplexity in regard to the taints spoken of by the ascetic. I do not doubt that they have been abandoned in me. This is a bold statement, to say that he has no doubt that all the obstructions, the taints, have been abandoned. This was his roaring of his lion's roar, recognizing that the taints of desire and attachment were completely eradicated within his mind. It's a rare accomplishment. In the Anguttara Nikaya, it says, few are born into the human realm, which is considered a fortunate birth. Few are endowed with wisdom. Few hear the Dhamma. Few practice. Few are stirred. Few strive properly. Few gain concentration. And few taste liberation. I'm often amazed at how frequently students ask me a rather bold question, maybe because I've never had the courage, or for that matter, the interest, to ask one of my teachers. And they usually ask things like, do you know anybody who's enlightened? And by the way, are you enlightened? Have you experienced Nibbana for yourself? Now, of course, it's a rather inappropriate question, because what would somebody do with the answer? Now, monastics are prevented by the rules of the Vinaya from answering anything or speaking in any way that would claim attainments, that would describe their attainments to lay people. Because the Buddha did not want monastics praising themselves in order to have gain. You know, I'm enlightened, give me alms. and he was very cautious about anyone falsely claiming awakening or concentration states, or any of the samadhi or insight states, or various meditative abilities. But of course, lay people don't have that prohibition. So we get asked this question. But what would it mean if I described experiences, if I declared either awakening or not awakening? Would it impress you? Would it cause you fear? Would you be happier if I was enlightened, or happier if I wasn't enlightened? What would inspire you? What would irritate you? What would spark comparison or judgment, envy? If I did claim to be awakened, what would that mean? Would you believe it, or would you not believe it? I remember back in the 1980s and 90s, one of my teachers, Christopher Titmus, experimented with answering this question in a very matter-of-fact way. He simply described and stated how he experienced his freedom. I found his statements to be incredibly clear and inspiring. They were powerful pointers to a profound depth that is possible in this life. But wow, there was really strong backlash against those kinds of statements within the Vipassana community. Honestly, most teachers that I know will not speak about awakening with personal references, although they might teach generally about the subject. And over time, a student might get a hint or a sense of whether or not the teacher seems to be speaking from direct experience or not, and if they seem to be living from that depth of realization in their everyday actions. Although I don't try to assess the level of awakening of my teachers, it would be a mistake for me to follow instructions from people, teachers, who may mean well but don't really know where the path is heading. So although we may not ask the questions so explicitly, in some way I think we do try to sort out who knows where this path is going. And can they show me that way? I should probably backtrack here and propose a few more basic questions for reflection. As I ask these questions, please just consider, reflect quietly on what response emerges within your own mind. Do you think of enlightenment as an experience that occurs in time? As an event? Does it have a duration? Is it always accessible? Can it be called forth at will? Is awakening an attribute of a person? If so, is it permanent? Is it temporary? Is it an aspect of that person's experience, sensory experience, mental experience? How does it affect their character? Is the awakening different from or the same as other accomplishments in the Buddhist practices, such as wisdom, knowledge, insight, non-clinging, non-identification? Is it accompanied by equanimity or happiness, bliss or rapture? Calmness or peace? Is the experience of oneness similar? Is the experience of awakening similar to the experience of oneness or union with the divine that we hear described in Hindu and Christian traditions. Does awakening arise automatically with the experience of emptiness or not self? If so, does that mean that everyone who's had a profound experience of emptiness is awakened? If not, what's the distinction between an insight into emptiness and awakening? Is there one single enlightenment moment or many in a lifetime? Are there defined stages of enlightenment and a predictable series of experiences or levels? Does somebody have a greater attainment if they have an experience that's repeated again and again, or if they have an experience that happens once? Is there a difference? A hierarchy? Is awakening a private internal experience? Or does it affect behavior and personality? Is it discernible only to the person themselves? Or is it discernible on the outside? And perhaps most importantly, how would somebody know if they were enlightened? Through the course of practice, so many spiritual experiences occur, transformative moments. Which ones are genuine awakenings? I've heard students confuse awakening with states that are obviously concentration states, or faith-based states, or insights into impermanence and not self, or heart openings of unconditional love. But the Buddha did not equate final liberation with momentary spiritual experiences. In Buddhism, awakening is described through a result, and the result is the ending of craving, clinging, conceit, and ignorance. Perhaps the most succinct definition is the complete eradication of greed, hate, and delusion. In the Samyutta Nikaya, it says, "That which is the exhaustion of greed, of hate, and of delusion is called Nibbana." One of the things that I've appreciated a great deal about the Theravada model, with 16 knowledges, 10 fetters, 11 corruptions of insight, and 4 progressive stages of enlightenment, is that this systematic analysis of it restrains the tendency to be satisfied with initial or minor attainments. When we know that there are 16 knowledges, 10 fetters, 11 corruptions of insight, and 4 progressive stages of enlightenment, we're not going to be impressed by just a tiny little achievement. So we're not so likely to stop short of the goal. There are many exciting attainments that happen in practice, but many of them are really only exciting from the perspective of the person who's never experienced it before. And this may be one reason why the early stages of a meditator's practice tend to be the most insight-packed phase. But a wise practitioner will not rest content with a relatively minor accomplishment in rapture, in concentration, in bliss, or experiences of luminosity or emptiness or peace. We must look further to see which fetters are abandoned at each phase of our development. We look for the result. We look at the degree of purification in our minds. There's a joyful, delightful moment that happens in interviews sometimes, but it's also a kind of difficult moment when students approach me and tell me of their accomplishments. Oh, 2 years ago, I was on that retreat and I had this experience and I was enlightened and this and that and this and that. And then there's the question, how should I respond? What's a skillful response? Too abrupt a response could be disappointing, even devastating for some students. But too enthusiastic a response can be interpreted as though the experience is more significant than it really is. Poonjaji, my teacher in India, was famous for incredibly enthusiastic, joyful support for the initial achievements and awakenings that everybody had. And it was delightful. It was always a cause for rejoicing whenever anybody spoke of any degree of spiritual understanding or experience. But unfortunately, many of those students only stayed with him for very brief visits and then misinterpreted their experience as being the ultimate realization confirmed by the guru. I find that when somebody describes their experience to me, they often need a little encouragement and want some encouragement for that attainment. And so a little bit of encouragement combined with a little bit of instruction to take the next step, to go a little further, is sufficient for most sincere practitioners. It nurtures their practice and it supports the development. But when you hear people claim states of awakening, I would encourage you to be a bit cautious, even a bit skeptical. Whether that's your own voice that's claiming a state of awakening or the voice of another. Much of what is touted as enlightenment in our contemporary spiritual marketplace, honestly, is not very impressive. Although perhaps those experiences and accomplishments may be greater than the average person, may be greater than other friends around, they're still usually relatively minor compared to the potential of this path. Christopher Titmus used to advise students to wait a year and a day before they even assessed the significance of spiritual experiences. But I don't think that's long enough. I say 5 years would be the minimum, because I've found that many experiences seem quite transformative and profound, and they linger for a long, long time. Experiences such as the perception of emptiness can give rise to long periods, years, where certain defilements don't arise, where the perception of suffering does not occur, and pervasive experiences of equanimity, boundless love, and deep samadhi or formless abidings can all linger for years. But it may be that those defilements re-arise again. We don't know. So we must test our attainments and our insights in the face of changing worldly conditions, the conditions of illness, of pain, of loss, of death, of exhaustion, of stress, of hunger, of financial strain, betrayal, work demands, and insults. We must test our realizations to see if the mind remains at peace through all the difficult experiences that happen, or if, once again, it defends illusory identities, if it forgets the simple fact that conditioned phenomena is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, if craving re-arises. The Buddha urged his disciples, do not fall short of the goal while there is still more to be done. I leave you with that instruction. Do not fall short of the goal while there is more, still more to be done.